Thursday in New York City. It's a wet one out there. Welcome to Insight on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrow. Happy to be with you for the next hour, leading up to Gary Knowles' hour. Always love to hear from you, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Well, perhaps last night you witnessed history in the making, Derek Jeter's last home game. But was it last night? Did you pay a lot of money for it? Hundreds, perhaps thousands of dollars? Well, tonight could be the last game. But if it gets rained out, last night was the last game. So if you went last night, you're psyched and you're hoping for rain to continue throughout today. So you can say, I saw the captain play his last game. Why not, right? What a class act, especially in light of what's going on with the NFL. He just really epitomizes what a sports star, a gentleman, an icon, you know, a role model should be. We all take our hats off here at PRN to Derek Jeter, and all the best to you, my friend. I'm sure he's going to land on his feet. I have no doubt he's going to be okay. So if you're listening to the show today on your Apple phone and your iOS system version 8, you may be Michelle a little bit. Some drop outs. Yeah. Version 8. Released probably a bit too soon. It's trash. It's garbage. Have you heard about this? Apple has a tendency to pre-release things too soon because they're always trying to stay on a cutting edge, which is cool. I respect them for that. But you know what? Keep it in the beta lab, man. Don't roll it out until it's absolutely flawless. So there's all kinds of glitches. So they're telling people, get it off your phone. If you go on their website, apple.com, you can find out how to purge it entirely from your phone. You lose calls. You don't get texts. It just basically craps out on you whenever you don't expect it. It'll happen. So that's why I actually never upload any new version of software, either for my PC, Mac, and especially my phone, because that's my lifeline. Because unless it's tried and true, my friends, I don't go there. So today, I don't usually bring up the day that I was born, but today is actually a celebration of my day. So many years ago, I was born on this day. And my wife and I have been joking. She's like, you know what? I'm going to take you to a very, very special birthday today. I said, really? She goes, yeah. You're going to love this place. They even take reservations. So you don't have to get that dressed up. But you know what? It's going to cost $100. I'm like, oh, wow. All right, well, what do you mean $100? How do you know how much it's going to cost when I don't know the menu and how much I'm going to drink, et cetera, et cetera. She goes, well, it's Olive Garden, 7 weeks of unlimited pasta. For $100, you can go there daily and gorge yourself with pasta, breadsticks, Coke, and salad. Well, salad kind of nullifies maybe the Coke, but that's about it. So only for $100. So isn't my wife the most generous and thoughtful and sensitive person in the world? Could you imagine that, going to Olive Garden for 7 weeks? 7 days a week for 7 weeks? How much weight you would put on? I think their average dish averages about 1,000 calories, get this, per serving. How many servings are probably in a typical pasta dish? Oh, man. So that's obviously a joke. I'm not going to the Olive Garden tonight for a special dinner. But maybe you are. And I'm not making fun of you. But just do yourself a favor and your loved ones. Don't go there 7 days a week because you're going to end up in the ER room real soon. Yeah, you will. Because you can't sustain so much food that really is not that healthy for you. Yeah, so they're trying to do everything in their power to save their own rear ends because Olive Garden is not doing well. They're sucking wind. So you can understand. No, I'm sorry. I still can't understand why they'd offer themselves like that because they are just being made fun of everywhere. Even I think the subway conductor on the number two line this morning made a joke about him. So unfortunately, more sad news rolls out of Rutgers. Man, I tell you, they just can't get out of their own way. And I'm not making light by any stretch of the imagination of the recent sad news. But there was a student, Caitlin Kovacs, that died over the weekend a young 19 years of age, very pretty girl, who appeared to have died of alcohol poisoning. It's still being determined. There are not too many statements coming out, except that they're waiting for the outcome, autopsy, et cetera, blood works, all the tests to be concluded to find out exactly what happened to Caitlin. She was actually at a frat party, Delta Kappa Epsilon, fraternity house on campus, I believe. She appeared to be in distress at about 3 a.m., and her friends drove her to the hospital. And she was pronounced dead moments after that. Very, very sad. So, of course, nothing new, binge drinking on the campuses of America. So it made me think certainly about what I did when I was in college. Binge drinking was the color of black. It was in vogue. And I did it quite often. I probably imbibed, drinking in general, I imbibed probably 5 days out of seven, safe to say. And I wouldn't just have one or two, because back then I couldn't have one or two, because what good is one or two drinks? You know, there's that, like, that precipice, like that threshold line. Like, can you go into a bar and just have one drink? It's hard. I can do it nowadays. Even sometimes it's a little bit hard. But nonetheless, back then in college, really, really hard to do. So yeah, as you probably heard me mention on previous shows, drinking was something I did rather too easily. And with my genetic makeup, my genes and my family, alcoholism rampant on both sides. That's something I learned I had to kind of stay away from. But it's a real shame that it does exist all over in the States. I mean, the stats here from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism defines binge drinking as a pattern of drinking that brings a person's blood alcohol concentration to 0.08 grams per cent or above. And this typically happens when men consume five or more drinks and when women consume four or more drinks in about 2 hours. 2 hours? I mean, wow, that seems like, to me, this probably tells you what a serious drinker I was. That doesn't seem like a lot. Yeah, right. Maybe I still have a problem. No, my tolerance is probably I would get drunk on the vodka pasta sauce at the Olive Garden. That's how low my tolerance is nowadays. But one in six U.S. adults binge drinks about four times a month, consuming about eight drinks per binge. Now, that's kind of scary. And the socioeconomic demographics also prove that they are middle to upper middle class. So the people who you would think would may have less to be drinking about, because obviously sometimes people drink to drown their sorrows, that's not the case. Maybe they have more to, obviously, alcohol or money does not buy happiness. We all know that. But it got me thinking about it, certainly binge drinking across the campuses. And poor Caitlin Kovacs, 19 years of age. Hopefully this will send a message, the concentric circles, the ripples, hopefully will be widespread nationally, and we can do something about this. But, you know, we live in a nation of binging. Binge watch a season of DVR shows. You know, how many people do you know are like, oh, I binge watch a whole season of Sopranos? Binge eating's been around since, well, you know, a long time. I think I probably could define a few of my friends who are binge daters. They even go on multiple dates a night. So I'm sure there are binge liars. We can call them binge liars. Hey, you could probably have like a movie concept, like we're like the binge nation. Certainly the country that, you know, can't get enough of a war. We have to go from one war to the next or have multiple wars simultaneously. Anyway, I digress. We're here to talk about binge drinking, and on the phone with me is Dr. Michael Friedman. He's a clinical psychologist known as Dr. Mike. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Wow. Sounds like you're in an echo chamber, my friend.
Does that not sound good?
Well, it sounds good if you're warming up in Radio City Music Hall.
All right, let me see if I can go someplace else. How's this?
Sounds pretty good. Sounds pretty good. So, you know, with another sad instance, as a matter of fact, weren't you recently connected as a teacher, professor at Rutgers?
I used to be a teacher at Rutgers.
Yeah. Yes. So I'm sure you probably feel this a little bit more than the average person, because nobody wants to see a student certainly loss of life at such a young age, 19 years of age. But, you know, binge drinking is serious stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that's been happening on campuses for years, certainly what's happening when I was at school way before me, and unfortunately I think it's going to continue for a long time. We're still going to keep seeing these kinds of tragic deaths.
And the numbers, actually, I'm surprised to find out that the what they term as regular drinking in college for the last 30 years, which depends on who you ask is regular drinking. I won't use myself as an example, but it seems to be rather steady. But binge drinking has just really spiked big time.
Yeah, I think that as more and more people learn about, you know, it spreads. You hear from your friends. Some people do it because they hear that they think it's fun. Some people do it because, you know, quote unquote, everybody's doing it. And so there's a spreading effect. I think more and more people are finding themselves at one point or another binge drinking.
Now, I imagine peer pressure, as you just alluded to, plays a major role in this. And what's the psychology of peer pressure? And what do you say to people who feel a major tugging to be a part of their peers and what they're doing?
So here's the thing that's very interesting with peer pressure as far as binge drinking. In the people that I work with, and I certainly think when I went through that period of time, I don't think it's as much what people would stereotypically think of as peer pressure, where they said, oh, come on, like, you need to do it, everybody's doing it. It's more this acknowledgement that a lot of people feel that the social life, particularly in college and even for young adults, is basically centers around drinking and in many cases binge drinking. So the thing that's a little bit subtle about it is that no one's really saying it. It's just that people wind up feeling like, well, I see people doing it. And they also feel oftentimes that if people around them are binge drinking and they're not, it's just not as much fun. So they have this very kind of awkward situation where they feel like the majority of their friends are out at bars or at parties and they're drinking. And if they're not, they really kind of have to self-select out, which I think is very uncomfortable for people.
And you know what? I mean, you can probably relate to this as well as many other college students or former college students, and myself included, is that, you know, sometimes you just don't have a lot of money. And so if you have, a bottle of vodka and there's five people in the room, well, you know what? Sometimes vodka just doesn't taste good, especially very cheap vodka like Popoff, to sip it, and, you know, when you probably don't have ice or any limes or lemons or anything. So what do? You chill it and you just slam it down. And that becomes kind of like fun, and they get a very, very quick effect immediately.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think I went through it, and I think a lot of people go through it. You know, especially if you're living in a big city like New York, where drinks can cost however much, you know, people say, well, I need to get buzzed before I go. And mm-hmm. So, you know, you could spend a couple of hours beforehand and downing four or five drinks, like you said, that
a little
would be
primer.
The criteria for binge eating, or excuse me, binge drinking is no problem.
Then comes the binge eating afterwards.
And then comes the binge eating, yes. If but, my experience is any indication,
yeah,
that would
exactly,
be the case.
Exactly. Now, this brings on a lot of other variables. Think about blackouts. Can you define a blackout before we continue?
I think it's just when you lose consciousness. And, you know, you have to remember that when you're talking about alcohol and the brain, alcohol is a depressant. And so what winds up happening is that, you know, certain nerves don't work as well. And that's one of the reasons why people wind up having alcohol poisoning, is because your respiratory system stops working. And so in the same way, if you do anything to your body too much, your body says, no more, and I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to kind of short circuit this whole thing, and you wind up blacking out.
What actually happens? Can you compare and contrast, for example, some of the examples I gave before? Say if an average person has a drink an hour for 3 or 4 hours, so they have 3 or 4 drinks, versus somebody who's been drinking, the effects on the brain. You just spoke about really what kind of happens to the brain, you know, when it happens very quickly. But the brain obviously has more time, and the body, more time to process alcohol when it's spaced out through a normal period of time.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like anything, you know, if you do anything, you know, over the course of a day or over the course of an evening versus in an hour, you know, it's going to be more of a toll on your body. And so I think that, you know, if your alcohol is having an effect on your brain, it's going to have less of an effect if it's spaced out, because, again, your body's going to have more of an opportunity to absorb it. And so getting to that dangerous level is going to be less possible.
Dr. Mike, is there any evidence that binge drinking can do long-lasting damage on the brain?
I'm not sure with the evidence that I've seen that that's necessarily the case. That doesn't mean it's not true. It's just that I don't know that I've seen the evidence that would say one way or another. I think that the evidence that we can definitely say is that the behaviors that are associated with binge drinking have a very high chance of having long-lasting problems, whether it's getting a DUI or, you know, getting, you know, alcohol poisoning where you have some kind of health problem, or just generally, you know, kind of not functioning as well as you could. That's definitely the case.
Yeah, and to continue on that list, unwanted pregnancies, STDs, rape, really poor judgment. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, it's really the kind of thing that over time just can, you know, and I see it, and it unfortunately gives me a lot of business. Like, it's, you know, it unfortunately can just completely undermine somebody's life, and they look back and they say, like, why aren't I where I want to be in my life? And they don't put it together, because after every night they come back and say, oh, either that was fun, or, you know, and they say things like, oh, you know, well, I get to work every day, and, oh, you know, I take care of my responsibilities. But as time goes on, you just start realizing that things just don't go as well. You know, your development winds up being limited.
Mm-hmm. And you develop a pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that one of the things that I'll see with people is that once you've been doing it, what people don't realize is that you start self-selecting for people who you're going to hang out with. You know, your friends become more likely people who will use. And so, you know, you wind up, you know, doing or not doing things around using. So you wind up staying up late at night. And so the idea of getting up in the morning, let's say, to exercise, or, you know, even to do different things that might be constructive, starts to not happen. And then once you've been doing it for years, it just seems the norm. And it winds up being the norm for you and the people in your life. And so that's why it becomes so dangerous, because it feels like I don't just have to stop binge drinking. I have to really change all these different things in my life. And, you know, people feel like it's too much.
Yeah, and it's scary.
It scares me.
I mean,
certainly, you know, I know when I went through it, and, you know, I binge drank for many years, and, you know, it was.
I liked you for a particular reason.
we connect on many levels.
Yes, we
definitely
do.
Definitely one of them. You know, it's. I look back and I think, you know, wow, you know, if one thing had just gone differently, you know that one little, you know, judgment that went the wrong way, my life could be very different, because it happened a lot, and I was in a lot of situations where, you know, it was dangerous, probably.
Now, is being a binge drinker a precursor to being an alcoholic?
That I don't know. I find that it generally, you know, definitely people who are alcoholic often binge drink. That is true. But I think there's definitely a subset of people who they don't necessarily. It's not even the alcohol so much. You know, so in other words, like, there are people who just like to binge. You know, so there's people who like to just do things very intensely. And so what they'll report is that they can go weeks without drinking, but then when they do drink, you know, they'll have like 8, 9, 10 drinks.
The floodgates go open.
Yeah, and so I think that there's, you know, a lot of it I think is genetic. You know, you talked about family history. So what I would say is that certainly if you binge drink and you have a family history or genetic predisposition, you're obviously much more likely to wind up you know, with alcohol dependence, whereas there are some people who they do it and they, you know, they go out and then the next day they don't really need alcohol, but 2 days later they might do the same thing, but they can walk away from it a little bit more. And, you know, so I think it's hard to tell.
You know, and it's been around a really long time. I actually started thinking about this topic last week, right after, unfortunately, the death of Kovacs. And I remember seeing an episode of Happy Days here and kind of date myself.
I'm right with you right there. So, you know,
Exactly. Richie Cunningham, I think, comes home. You know, he's pretty pie-eyed. And I forget what the father's name was. The father was like, you know.
Howard Cunningham.
Howard, exactly. Howard says, you know, Richie, you know, did you have anything to drink? He's like, yeah, I had just a little beer. And he, like, gives the symbol of, like, a shot glass. He's like, oh, really? Okay, well, that's not bad. He goes, well, Howard said, well, the father, well, how many did you have? He's like, well, 72 or something like that, you know. And, of course, you know, back then it was like, whoa, you know, 72. I think that was maybe his precursor to going to college. But it just made me think about how even in media, certainly nowadays, modern times, I mean, this is displayed all the time in terms of going behind the velvet ropes to be VIP at a club where you pay, you know, an exorbitant amount of money for a bottle or bottles. And people just go crazy. And obviously we see it again and again in nightclubs, hear about the news, whether they're stars or celebrities or the average person who just gets completely annihilated and goes out and try to, whether drive a car or, you know, unfortunately uses really bad moral judgment and does something bad or unlawful against the opposite member of sex.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate, you know, because in a lot of ways those stories do two things. One is they perpetuate, you know, the notion that this is common. And, you know, obviously someone going out and, you know, being at a club is going to get a lot more attention than someone that goes home and is in bed by 10 o'clock
and has that,
you know,
sex
wakes
appeal
up in the morning to help their kids. And so I think that, you know, I don't, part of what I do is I don't like to judge anyone for living a certain way. But the problem is that when you see prominent people in the media who are doing it, it's not so much that they're doing it, or it's not so much a problem to say that this is an option, but it gives the impression that this is just what people do. And this is particularly what you do if you're successful. It's a sign of success. And that's a dangerous message, because the truth is that, yes, that may be something that some people do as a sign of success, but generally speaking, one of the things that I think creates success is staying away from those situations, at least long-term success.
It's PRN.FM. My name is Mark Fowler. Joining me is Dr. Michael Friedman. We're talking about binge drinking. Unfortunately, the Rutgers student died last Saturday, or Sunday morning, absolutely, technically. Caitlin Kovacs, 19 years of age. It's not a final, the determination how she died, but it's probably speculated that it appeared to be alcohol poisoning. Now, how do you identify a binge drinker? Obviously, you ask them questions, and you can obviously easily stipulate by their behavior and character that, well, they're a binge drinker, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that for the most part, you know, and again, you're not there, you know, so I can't say for sure. But generally speaking, I think that when people binge drink, they tend to be pretty upfront about the fact that they binge drink. So in other words, like the thing that people might be a little less honest about was like how far into binge drinking they get. So in other words, someone might say like, oh, you know, I only had like 7 or 8 drinks that night. And when you kind of probe a little bit, it's more like they had 12 or 15. But as far as kind of getting to the point where here's someone who's drinking a lot versus somebody who's not, again, you know, people obviously could be lying, but I think people are pretty upfront about their tendency to do that. I think sometimes with alcoholism, people tend to be a little less honest because there are things that are maybe happening more in secret, or things that are happening a little bit more regularly, and the fears of what it will mean to kind of divulge that, I think, are greater. But for people who binge drink, I think that most people, especially young people, they don't see anything wrong with it. So they're just like, oh, yeah, you know, I go out 4 or 5 times a week and I have about 8 drinks, and it doesn't occur to them. So I feel like, you know, without knowing for sure, that people are pretty upfront about their binge drinking.
I think they're proud and even boastful.
Yeah, look what I did. Yeah, and it's very it's tough when you're treating people, especially when you're treating people for something that you yourself struggled with for so many years. You know, because I remember being back then, and I remember being out in situations and kind of wondering, like, this, you know, my life's not going exactly the way I want to. And I had friends who said, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't drink so much, and be like, what? You know, that's
how is that going to have any impact on my life?
I'd like to hear what plan B is. And so, you know, I certainly get when people kind of look at me, you know, and I remember there was definitely a time where someone said to me, like, I want you to not drink for a month. You know, I've no way, like my whole life would collapse. So, you know, you see people basically giving you that same look and thinking like there's just simply no way my life can be the same without drinking. But the nice thing is that what you also see is that when people try, they're like, oh, like, wow, you know, like I, you know, I'm looking to meet a significant other, and it didn't occur to me that that significant other is probably not as likely to be met after 12 o'clock at a club when I'm completely blasted as much as maybe if I wake up early in the morning and I'm going out for a run, or, you know, I'm doing something in the community, that maybe that's more of a likely place. And I think, you know, also just like the state that you're in when you meet people. And I think when people start putting those things together, they start feeling better, things, you know, they're doing better at work, exercising, they're eating better, then all of a sudden they're like, oh, yeah, this is a better life, actually.
You described me, actually.
Yeah.
No, it's really what I did. At 35, I kind of, you know, had a very small intervention and basically said to myself, well, the other people kind of brought me to this intervention, but then I said, hey, I don't want to wake up at 40, be an alcoholic, be single, and, you know, be a little bit despondent, possibly.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was kind of similar for me, like, in the sense that I one day I was kind of like, you know, let's just look at the facts, like look at how things are going. And it's kind of like, well, you know, just why don't you stop drinking for a little bit? And once I stopped, it was sort of like, you know, just like, wow, like things are
different. I can survive.
Yeah, like, well, I survive. And I feel pretty confident that if I had continued to drink the way that I had, like I met my wife soon after that. And I feel very confident that she would not have been particularly pleased with my behavior. You know, now, several years later, you kind of try to, you know, drink a little bit more moderately and try that. But I think, you know, I needed to kind of really just wipe all of that away.
Absolutely.
And then re-enter.
Clean the slate there.
Yeah.
Now, how do you lose the binge and just be a drinker? How do you give people advice on that?
Well, that's also a tough one personally, because I personally never enjoyed that. You know, I just to me, it was sort of like the idea of, you know, having a couple, it just, I, you know, to be honest, it just never really made sense to me. Like, it wasn't particularly enjoyable. And, you know, at
the time, all or nothing, baby.
Yeah, it really felt like that. But I think that what, you know, when you're talking about sort of the benefits of drinking, you know, and you think, like, let's say a binge is, you know, five drinks within a couple of hours, and you think to yourself, all right, well, what is it that you like about drinking? Well, I like that it keeps me involved socially. Like, I get a little bit of a buzz, you know, and you think, like, well, what don't you like? Well, I don't like when I start really talking loud, and, you know, I embarrass myself sometimes, and I'm obnoxious. And you think, well, like, where's that crossover point? And people kind of know, you know what I mean? Like, they know that, like, after three drinks, things start to go bad, or after four drinks. And so one of the things that I try to do with people is say, all right, look, let's see where that drinking line is, where you can get the most good and minimize as best as possible the bad. And that's something that actually feels appealing to people, because they like the idea that, oh, like, you know, I can still do this, but, like, what if I could go out and, like, have a couple of drinks and, you know, not wake up the next morning and kind of not know what happened, or, you know, just feel like I, you know, I have no more money left,
or remorse.
You know, who knows who I have to apologize to for whatever silly thing I said. And so that's the way that I tend to work with people, and that I think it can be appealing.
Are you surprised that the prevalence of binge drinking still exists so much in campus, and more importantly, post college?
Oh, no. In fact, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I think that the way it seems to be, and again, I think it was similar for me, is like post college is just like college with money. You know what I mean? Like, when you're after, it's like all of a
well
sudden
put.
You have your, you know, it's like, it's the same. I mean, I remember visiting people I knew from college when I was still in college, and then they graduated. And I'm like, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, you guys have your own apartments. Like, you know, everybody's
steady income.
Have, you know, everybody's got money. Instead of, like, you know, sitting in someone's basement and drinking, like, you know, not so great alcohol, like, we're out, like, you know, having good stuff, and it just feels good. It feels, you know, in theory, it felt more adult, you know. And so I'm not surprised at all as people, you know, are going out there and sort of some, you know, some people taking them longer to kind of figure out what they want to do with their life. So there's almost this sense that, you know, it's like taking longer for people to get to that point where, like, all right, I'm going to settle down and kind of, you know, so to me, it makes total sense. And that's kind of how people, you know, who I work with report it.
I turned 48 today, and I have to tell you a funny story. My wife and I, oh, thank you very much. My wife and I, I'd say in the last 5 to 7 years, we were late getting married and late having children. So we're kind of, you know, behind the curve and get to see a lot of our friends when their kids are a little bit older, how they act, et cetera. So we would go out on date night or whatever with our friends without kids. And they would be slamming. Like, one of them actually ordered a bottle of champagne. The wife just ordered a bottle of champagne for herself. And so we would get home and we'd be like, oh my God, like, can you believe how much they downed, you know, in a short period of time? I'm like, what is it? What is it? And then we had kids.
Yeah.
So then we realized, oh my God, you know, you don't get time out. And it is a little bit like binge drinking, where you really, you know, like tonight I'll go out and I'll probably have two or three glasses of wine, and I can't have more than that because I just don't drink frequently enough, so I will just not be comfortable.
Yeah, when you think about, you know, like I think, you know, I'll talk with my wife about it, because we also got married a little bit later and have you know, a little bit younger kids than some of the people that we know. Mm. And it's like, you don't realize like how many escapes you had on a regular basis when have kids. You know, you could sleep in all day or like, I mean, just, you know, obviously anyone with kids knows these things. And so I think that for people who use binge drinking as an escape, the allure is going to be so much. I mean, some people are just like, I just can't wait to just kind of get away from it all. And they just want, you know, they want to physically be away. They want to emotionally be away. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, here I still see a lot of binge drinking. And in a lot of ways, it's a very similar thing with post-college. It's like not, you know, now people really have their own houses, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people I know. And, you know, we aspire to this to a certain extent without necessarily the binge drinking. But, you know, you want your backyard to have kind of a party vibe. Like you want your friends to come over for, you know, barbecues and, you know, be able to really enjoy themselves. So, yeah, I feel like, you know, you kind of see how binge drinking just kind of sustains itself throughout the lifespan.
And going back to my point, I think I understand certainly why, number one, my friends did what they did and still do. And we are kind of following their footsteps, not to that extreme. And also another important variable is time. You have so much limited time. If you're only out for 2 or 3 hours, 4 hours possibly, the time is clicking, ticking, whether it's a babysitter or whatever, logistics. So I kind of get that. And I guess one of my final questions to you, Dr. Mike, is for people who are aware they binge drink, what variables and actions should they be aware of just to keep them safe in the present state and model that they're in?
Well, I think that, you know, harm reduction is, to me, you know, obviously the first thing is to really kind of see, can you reduce the binge drinking? And I think that there's, you know, if people want to look up the concept of motivational interviewing, where you basically kind of compare, like, well, what's, you know, what are the benefits, what are the costs, and then try to, like I was saying before, try to estimate where the benefits still happen and the costs aren't as much. That's definitely been shown to be an effective way of managing binge drinking. But if you're not, you know, going to do that or you don't want to do that, there's still tons of things you can do to reduce harm. You know, very basic things that we've been learning for years about drinking and driving. You know, if you're worried about, are you going to be able to help with the kids in the morning, you know, making sure that, you know, maybe the kids are, you know, with a babysitter, someone's parents, you know, what have you, making sure that, are you the kind of person that tends to get a little belligerent when you're drinking? If you're someone who gets belligerent when you're drinking, don't be at a bar, be at, you know, a restaurant at a table, be at somebody's house. You know, and you really kind of think through all the different things. Like if you approach alcohol poisoning, how do you take the same number of drinks and space them out, or drink water intermittently, or eat? So there's a lot of things that you can do to reduce the harm, even if you don't want to reduce the binge drinking. But, you know, obviously reducing the overall alcohol intake is probably the best thing to do, not only for, you know, helping the behaviors that are problematic, but also just the health effects.
Now, I think college students, it's safe to say everyone is impacted by binge drinking, whether you drink or not, because on campus or in a fraternity or a sorority house, I mean, you're going to be impacted either by someone saying something, by someone's actions, et cetera. So what would you say to parents and or college students that who are likely going to continue binging because everyone thinks they have it under control? Is there any insight or safe directions or binge advice you can give?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'm worried about with my kids. I mean, my kids are young, so it's a little farther away from that. But yeah, when I think about going to college and I think about people around who might be drinking or, you know, and how it in some cases can ruin other people's times, that's something that I definitely worry about. I think what I would say to people, to parents and to students is, try as best you can to anticipate realistically what a certain social situation is going to bring. You know, like, and kind of think like, all right, well, what are things that I like to have happen? Like, you know, and sometimes it sounds silly because it's like, well, that's so obvious, but oftentimes people don't do that. It's like, oh, you know, what are you doing? We're going to party. You want to come? Great. And you don't really think to yourself like, all right, well, is this a place where you're, you know, everybody's going to be drinking? Is this a place where if people are drinking, people are going to be fighting?
Sure, and have that reputation.
Yeah, and you could probably anticipate ahead of time and say, hey, listen, like, you know, maybe not that, but why don't we do something else? Or, you know, and I think that just that alone, if more people did that, even though it's not, you know, sort of high level, it's, you know, kind of being aware of what it is that you like or don't like or what might happen or not happen and avoiding situations as best as you can, people would be surprised at how much, you know, they can move their life in the direction that they want. You know, they always feel like, oh, well, my friends are doing this or friends are doing that. It's like, you know, you can say to people, like, look, I don't do that as much anymore. You know, if you're going to a fraternity party, that's fine. That's just not what I do. And you go and we'll hang out beforehand and I'll see you the next day and that's fine. And so, you know, whereas other people say, no, I like a fraternity party. And then you have to sort of say, all right, well, like any other party, you just have to be careful of certain things. And so I think that really it's about kind of just thinking about the data that you have and anticipating to the best of your ability what's most likely to have a positive outcome for you.
Sure. And a long-term effect you can think about, consider in terms of thinking ahead is that, you know, obviously social media, people get videotaped doing everything from the ice block of shots to whatever tables of, you know, binge drinking you're doing. That makes it up onto the web. And then you're looking for a college recruiter in 6 months, and then they start thinking you're a great prospect, and then they see what you were doing at some sorority or fraternity party, and then that can just really take you out of the running
internship. That's a whole other thing that, you know, in retrospect, like, you know, I even remember when there would just be pictures, you know, of drinking or, you know, kind of how silly you looked when you were drinking.
Kind of inane if you look back at
it. But they stayed, you know, they stayed in my friend's drawers as opposed to
exactly.
It's a very scary thing. And I think that it's, you know, that is somewhat unfortunate that there's hardly any privacy anymore.
Sure.
But, you know, you have to. You know,
but more reason to really kind of, you know, reel it back in.
Yeah, and I think that it's another example. It's like, look, if you don't want to get photos taken of you, don't go to a big club where people are just able to snap shots whenever they want. You know, and that's why some people say, like, look, if I'm going to drink, I like to do it in, you know, my apartment or, like, with a few people rather than something that, you know, they're just kind of doing out. Whereas, you know, other people say realistically, like, you know, I don't care as much, but, you know, I think, like you said, it's just important to think it through. You know, what's your long-term plan here, and how do these things fit or not fit into it?
Now, Dr. Mike, as a clinical psychologist, this is probably out of your purview, and if you don't have to answer this, or you can answer this as an everyday person, but any signs or symptoms that a binge drinker or anyone who's kind of getting inebriated could be slipping into a point of alcohol poisoning?
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably objectively, I would say it's hard to know. But certainly, you know, if you're seeing somebody where they seem like their consciousness is compromised, they're slurring their words, and yet they're still drinking at the same rate, I think that that's probably a good indication. I mean, if you're kind of just putting it in, you know, in order, you just say, like, well, to the extent that someone can do this, like keeping track of just number of drinks and kind of thinking, like, all right, that's 10 drinks in 2 hours. Okay, that's probably, you know,
excessive.
A little bit of a risk.
if you're
slurring or stumbling or, you know, you're kind of fading in and out and the drinking is still coming, that's a problem. And so I would say that those are two things that I would look for right away that would say, you know, you might be moving in this direction.
Dr. Mike, all the best to you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
And actually, one more quick thing. You know what I just realized on the heels of what we were just saying? And I know this is common, and this is probably a kind of a foul thing to end on, but it's true. And I unfortunately have to raise my hand when I give this statement that once or twice when I was in college, binge drinking, and you felt, well, you know what? You're reaching your capacity and or you feel like you're about to get sick. So one went and purged, or goes and purges, and then comes back to the table full of vigor and life and continues to binge. And that's really unsafe.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that people don't know, and this comes up a lot with bulimics that they don't realize, is that most of what you ingest, not most, but at least 50% of what you ingest, happens right on the way down. So this notion that, you know, you could binge like 5,000 calories and then throw it up, yeah, but you're still taking in 2,500 calories for the most part. And I think that I would suspect that it's the same thing with alcohol. Like, yes, you know, you have 10 drinks and you feel like, okay, I throw it up and I'm fine. But what probably is happening is that the majority, or at least a lot of the alcohol, is still getting absorbed in the system. So it's that's something that is probably not a great way of doing it. And just going back to our other discussion, it's something that unfortunately, especially I know for young men, it's kind of seen as a sign of manhood to be able to do that.
Yeah, beat your chest and yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like people who like throw, you know, when they exercise and they throw up and they start exercising again. It's, you know, I guess it is somewhat impressive on some level that you have the ability to do it, but it's, you know, it's really not all that impressive in terms of what you're doing to your body.
And far from healthy, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Dr. Mike, all the best to you. Thank you so much.
Take care, Mark. Thanks
have a great
much.
Day.
All right. Take care.
PRN.FM. We'll be right back in a minute with Insight, and we'll be talking about the suicide rate in New Jersey off the George Washington Bridge continues to climb, and we're going to find out what the GWD, GWB, and the Port Authority is doing about it next on Insight. It's Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you so much for joining me on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Happy Rosh Hashanah to everyone celebrating this great day. Didn't realize the literal translation is head of the year. So happy new year to all those out there celebrating it. I will be celebrating that and much more tonight as it's my birthday and I will be binge drinking, carefully binge drinking. And a special thanks to my former guest, Dr. Michael Friedman. And coming at the top of the hour, Gary Null, the proprietor, owner, very insightful gentleman who runs this great satellite radio station here. It's Gary Null at noon. Love to hear from you at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Unfortunately, so far in the year of 2014, 13 people have died, and at least 45 attempts have been avoided from the George Washington Bridge. Last week alone, are you familiar, our local audience certainly will, our international audience will not be, but there's a bridge not too far from New York City in New Jersey called the Driscoll Bridge, kind of known as the Parkway Bridge. And there's a sister bridge right next to it, an older bridge, kind of termed the Route 9 Bridge. And one single day, within an hour or two of each other, two people leapt to their death. And they didn't realize that actually they were getting calls from 911. And they were really kind of discombobulated because they didn't realize there was two happening pretty much simultaneously. So between that and the high numbers at GWB, there is a decision by the Port Authority of New York that they're going to be spending $50 million to construct a suicide fence. This is going to be a 9-foot barrier to help prevent would-be jumpers. And it's being designed and it won't be completed until 2022. That seems like a really long time to put up a fence. Granted, it's probably going to be structural and they have to manufacture this and install it. And obviously, that's lane closures. That's a lot of things. But geez, I mean, if you think about the number of people, okay, 13 and we're, well, 3/4 of the way through the year, say 15 a year, 15, 30, 45, you know, we're going to lose another 100 people or so. But anyway, at least there's progress being made. Now, the Port Authority follows California's Golden Gate Bridge officials who, after 60 years of resistance, finally announced that they are going to install a $76 million suicide prevention net. It's going to be a net. It's going to be installed underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. Wow. Now, will this prevent them from dying and will they sustain some sort of injury? Because that is a bigger bridge, I believe, than a GWB. And, wow, I mean, a net, that's got to be some serious net and really well devised and installed. Could you imagine if someone actually leapt looking to take their life and then survived but got hurt on the net and then they sued the operators of the Golden Gate Bridge? I could see that happening. It's almost like you have to have them sign a waiver. I know on a George Washington Bridge there are signs posted every, I don't know, 25, 50, 100 feet that are distress signs and phones. I think the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention was pivotal in lobbying the Port Authority and having these installed. And, you know, for a person who's really in distress and they're thinking about taking their life, are they really going to stop and read a sign and pick up the phone and say, hey, you know what, I'm on the north side of the GW outbound lane and I'm thinking about cashing it in. You think that would make a difference? Now, there's a suicide attempt, or almost a suicide attempt, every day or every other day at the Golden Gate Bridge. And that's the most popular suicide site in the country. Really scary and nasty, horrible statistic. Now, will this really reduce the rate of attempts, suicide completions? You know, will people in distress find another means? Trains, obviously, are a very violent way. Men usually choose more violent methods. You know, working here in New York City, buildings are, you know, rampant. And a lot of the doors on top of the buildings, you know, are not locked. Unfortunately, the building where I lived, where my brother successfully completed a suicide, was not locked. Would that have saved his life? It's hard to say. Would they have chosen another means? That's what the bigger question is. Now, there's an interesting study. Stanford University mental health expert Keith Humphrey cites one fascinating study, and I wanted to read this to you. It found that when ovens changed, now this goes back a little bit, but still the case is still pretty clear here, that when ovens change over from carbon monoxide producing coal to gas in the 1960s, the suicide rate in Britain fell by about one-third. It fell about one-third. While other means of suicide did rise slightly, but nowhere near the canceled-out benefit of having such an easy method of a suicide removed from just about, you know, everyone's kitchen in Britain. So that's an interesting little study I wanted to include there, because you have to think about, you know, kind of the fallout. What could possibly happen? Now, obviously, the GWB is famous for many things, and certainly back in 2010, Tyler Clementi, an 18-year-old Rutgers student whose roommate filmed him having a gay encounter, he jumped off there in September. So that is 4 years ago. And they actually started a very, well, fairly successful foundation, which is doing a lot of good, the Tyler Clementi Foundation out of Rutgers. And I think they're actually teaming up with UMDMJ, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey. If you want any information on that, you can find that online. But this is a very, very pivotal and serious and critical issue here. But I'm glad, you know, well, that they are spending the money, but the Port Authority is kind of getting a little, a bit of a second look, wondering why so much money, $50 million is being spent just to construct a suicide fence. And will this really prevent deaths? And of course, the Port Authority does not have the greatest of track records with money and expenses and budgets and excessive payouts, bloated and inflated salaries, you name it. But this is something I cannot argue with the least. Love to hear your feedback. 888-874-4888. If you had a loved one and their life was saved because of a fence and or a net, which would be the case for the Golden Gate Bridge, I imagine you'd be very happy that money was spent, taxpayer money. Hope that is the case. Anyway, so positive news moving forward there. People were once also saying, the naysayers, well, it's really going to obstruct the view as well. Really? Are you really parking your car in the GWB and really glancing out at the beautiful river there? You know, the Hudson? Are you really doing that? I don't think so. If it saves some lives, suck it up. So again, it's Rosh Hashanah. Happy New Year to everybody. Going to be enjoying a nice birthday meal tonight. And it's kind of the time of the year, the one time of year, I really kind of take time to muse just kind of how lucky I am. And I hope you do that too as well. It can be on your birthday. It doesn't have to be on your birthday, but you kind of take stock of what you have. And I think about a woman who I found, when I sobered up, like my last guest said, Dr. Mike, same for me, sobered up and found a great woman. She, who loves me for me. I got children that are beyond exceptional in every possible way a parent could ask for. Two very exceptional children. Very, very thankful. Exorbitantly happy. A mother, a soon-to-be mother. Well, she's not soon-to-be. She's my mother. Soon-to-be a second-time cancer survivor. So we wish Peggy Farrell all the best there. Still appreciate all the small things in life. Small is a good Italian sandwich. Nice ride, summer day, windows down, bike ride, workout in the gym, building something around the house, a swim, good conversation, glass of wine, sunrise, sunset, traveling. Still dedicated to helping out others and taking care of the temple. You got to take care of yourself, man. As you get older, it's more and more important. I found myself this morning actually in the gym, 5:15 this morning. Yeah, I'm taking care of my temple, 5:15. Looking in the mirror, and it's weird because I wasn't really consciously aware of looking at myself longer, but I never really look at myself, like look at myself. Just want to make sure my hair doesn't look totally freaky, and I move on. Once in a while, I actually look at my teeth to see if they're brown or not, or white, and I'm happy that they're white. But anyway, this morning I kind of took a look, and then I realized I was looking longer, and I'm like, oh, yeah, well, it's my birthday. I guess I'm looking, I don't know, am I looking into my soul? Am I just looking to see if I'm getting older? Probably my old ass is looking older. Who knows? But I did take a little bit of a longer gander, and I was just wondering why that is. Well, at least I was aware that I was doing it. And when you have really bad eyes, you got to go really close to the mirror. People are probably like, why is that guy so vain looking? No, I just can't see, man. I just can't see. Anyway, it's been a great day broadcasting with you, talking about binge drinking. Special thanks to Dr. Michael Friedman. As always, he gives great insight, great feedback, and just one hell of a nice guy. All the good guys around here, Jason Taubenfeld, Casey, Giselle, couldn't do without you. Special thanks to Luke. Hey, Luke. Hey, Luke. Luke is my son. Across the board, the table here. His mic is here, but he's not talking because he's shy. Thanks for coming here, Luke. Thanks to Gary Null. He's up next. My name is Mark Farrell. It's PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. See you next Thursday.